this will be an Action Jackson here. So here we go. Oh, yeah.
I know all you guys have been waiting all week long to hear this.
All right. It's that time, whether you're driving to work or you're mowing your lawn, it's now time to talk some shop. I'm Dave Rupert, and with me, as always, is Chris Coyer. Chris?
I'm happy to be here, guys.
This is really good. So we don't have a special guest this week. Oh, no. But you probably knew that by the title of this episode, because this week is a Chris...
Rapid fire show.
Yeah.
We have no guests, no drama, no links, no nothing but question on answer action. That's my favorite Dave saying.
Oh, yeah. We got a whole bunch of question on answer action.
I wonder if we could make the thought. So that guy loves putting things on the ends of arrays.
Push it. Oh, hold on. I got one.
Waka, waka, waka. Yes.
That's good. You said no jokes, Chris. And there you go. Starting things off with a joke.
Oh, we got some good ones in the can, too. Okay. We're going to kick the
whole point of this is that we do it fast and we do more questions than we would on a regular show. So let's start this one off with Jason Sandberg's question. Thanks for your question, Jason. A few years ago, if you wanted to view content on the web, you just opened your favorite web browser on your computer and you went to that website. Today, there are more ways than ever to view the web, right? We all know this. iPad, iPhone, Android device, other tablets, etc. Essentially, viewing the internet on your TV might be more standard. I think he's saying like, kind of like in the future, maybe that'll be the case.
Future.
Even web. With so many ways to access the internet, user interaction with a website changes depending on the device. For instance, on your computer, you have a mouse, right? So you can... Do rollover actions with your mouse. You get cool interaction with the content, like a top navigation bar with drop-down menus. On the iPad or other tablets, there's no mouse to roll over these elements, which makes that type of interaction impossible. My question is, how can we create a website with all the devices in mind for the user interaction and keep the same functionality, or do we end up creating a separate website for each device type? If dealing with different browsers was not enough, now we have different devices. He's very right about this. You have a mouse and you have a keyboard when you're on a laptop or you're sitting at home on your desk, like where I am right now and where Dave probably is right now. I don't know where Dave records this, but I assume he's got a keyboard.
I'm in a space station.
That makes tons of sense.
Using Google goggles.
Yeah. I can press on my website, you know, like if I'm on twitter.com, I can just press F and I'll favorite the tweet that I'm on. I can't do that on my iPad. I can click and drag, you know, or I could right click and get a contextual menu when I'm in Chrome here on my desktop. There's all these things like that, command keys and mousing around and that type of thing that are just impossible on tablet or touch style devices. That's pretty weird situation. How do we deal with that, Dave?
Well, so I like to cite this article by my coworker Trent Walton called Non-Hover. It's a little old, but it's still relevant. Basically, it sums up that because we can't depend on hover anymore, it's out. Like, don't make any of your key interactions based on hover. I would also go ahead. I mean, you can get into like making a whole mobile site or tablet site or blah, blah, blah. But like, honestly, like, do you have the money for that? Like, do you have the infrastructure to like maintain four or five different sites, like at all times, you know, like your .tv site and your .mobile, your .tablet, your, you know, like, do you have the money and infrastructure to do that? If not, which I mean, most people I talk to don't. Then, like you got to kind of just find the lowest common denominator and make sure, which is also like an accessibility issue.
Possibly
as well,
the greatest common multiple.
There you go. Oh, wow. Okay. All right. Okay. So math joke.
You want your you want the best of the of what you can get, you know?
Not yeah,
the
yeah.
Worst.
Yeah, you're not just like, oh, I'm just going to make it terrible all the time. You just got to like figure out how to make it, you know, like if you have a star that highlights, make sure, you know, if you tap that star, it you know, that's a, right. Also a way to favorite something. Another issue is like content parity is kind of a key phrase that's been passed around. You got to make sure your mobile and your tablet and your website have access to all the same content. That for me is becoming a larger and larger issue. I feel like just because I'm on the, like, I don't want a dumbed down feature set because I went on my iPad. I'm on my iPad because like my computer's broke or I'm just on the couch or something, you know? So
mm-hmm.
that,
so it wouldn't bother you per se if there was a website that didn't work particularly well in it because it's not for the, or
sort of, well, like, let me call somebody out. I'm calling out. This is a call out. Like the Twitter site. Like Twitter for mobile is great. Like Twitter for desktop is super fun. Twitter for iPad is like a version behind, kind of. And what I do is okay. Like when I get like a follow email, I like go click view the person's profile. I like click to go see their website and like, I just enjoy doing that, you know? And so like I'll go in, but if you do it on the iPad, you can't, they don't have the person's URL listed. So you can't like go click to the person's web, you know, it's just sort of frustrating to me. It's just like, guys, I,
so are you talking about the app or the website or what?
Yeah. Well, this is just the website. So this is like when I, okay. when I'm in my mail application, I click a link to view their profile. I get to the, it opens.
Yeah. Mobile okay. Safari. So you open twitter.com in Safari on the iPad.
Yeah.
And
so
that is not great.
Yeah. That website is maybe just like a half version or oh, behind the big site. So
we often yeah. don't think of like versions of websites, but I understand what you're saying there. When you said version, I was like, I was thinking of Twitter, the app for iPad, which confusing, literally our yes. version and is also behind, but in a good way, kind of like it's, I don't know. I think enough. Twitter for iPad, the app is pretty sweet.
Yeah. Yeah. So I just, for me, it's just like, if you are going to try to target all these devices, You need parity. You need them to be the same, like have the same functionality. And for me, the best, this is my deal, but responsive web design, go, go, go.
Sure. You'd think that they, I wonder if they do, or if they, do you think it's a fork? Do you think when you land on twitter.com on your iPad, you get a totally different code base than you get?
I think you do. I think you get a fork, but I think the views that are on the app, the phone app, like dot app and the dot com, I think those views are probably the same HTML. I think they're HTML and maybe not iOS. I'm just going to chuck that out there. I don't know. I know Facebook is like that.
So I would bet they are too. Yeah. Facebook is, it's everything they do is ultimately the view or, you know, the, like the design and the layout and the content and stuff is HTML.
Mm-hmm.
Which is smart, I think. Yeah. So, Jason, you lose hover for sure. So if you're worried about hover, that one's out. So don't put key functionality in hover. You also lose the keyboard. So anything that you want to put on a desktop version that is a keyboard shortcut, that is a bonus. That is literally a shortcut, not the only way you can accomplish it, but just a bonus so that on a mobile device, there's still an alternate way to do it that works. You lose kind of contextual menus. You can't right-click on a tablet device, so don't bury important functionality within that as well. But other than that, you know, I think you're okay. Even if you have drag and drop, there are, you know, the way that you would write that on the web is different, but there are tap events events and touch events or whatever where you can simulate drag and drop. So if your app depends on that, that's true. I think a bigger deal than the functionality, which is a big deal, is just making sure that your layout makes sense. So if you have a drag and drop heavy website, it's probably because there's some things on one part of the screen that you need to drag to another part of the screen. Well, remember, on a lot of touch screen devices, there isn't a whole heck of a lot of screen space, especially on something like an Android phone or whatever. There's just not a lot of room there. So even if you replicate those touch events and make some drag and drop functionality, do you have the screen space to deal with that? Does your layout make sense? I don't know. It is a brave new world out there, Jason, and I don't have all the answers for you, but you're definitely thinking in the right way that there's different interactions between the two things, and there's no perfect answers. Again, it is often hard to talk in generics about this type of thing. It's easier when we are pointing at some real interaction.
I think the capacity, like device capabilities, are probably the next frontier in how to do really cool stuff. So
yeah,
good luck.
And they get ones that we don't have. You can pinch and swipe and stuff like that that you can't. I saw this demo of somebody made swiping a requirement to change pages on the desktop. So you had to click and drag, like I've never seen that on the desktop before. Like change pages by click and drag swiping. And I was like, ooh, good luck with that, dude. That's weird. That's trying to port a tablet interaction back to the web, which usually you see it in the other direction, kind of like, how can we get I don't know, it was weird. Brave new frontier. Next
is a question from Rick Messer.
Hi guys, this is Rick Messer. I'm a web designer from Denver. I have a question about indentation in HTML. I've seen different types of output in terms of indentation. My WordPress themes always have crazy indentation that I didn't intend them to have. I've also seen some sites that have no indentation at all, and all lines are just justified all the way to the left. I like the indentation I create when coding up my initial HTML. How do I keep that from being interrupted by WordPress or another CMS? Also, I'd like to know what you think are the best practices for nesting elements in terms of indentation. Do you like to use full-on tabs or the two-spaced soft tab or soft indentation? Thanks.
Okay.
The only reason this matters at all is because of readability for yourself and for your team. So you need, if you're browsing by yourself, then just do whatever you want that feels good and is readable for you. If you're working with other people, maybe have a quick meeting about it and discuss it. One of the parts of this question was about view source and how it looks indentation wise. You're like, gosh, I program a WordPress site and I view source and it looks wacky. You should try and just wipe that from your mind if possible. It absolutely doesn't matter what your view source view looks like. Maybe it's a fun little bonus if it looks okay, but even developers hardly even do that anymore because we have such good development tools that allow us to inspect things. I would say that worrying about what your view source looks like, it absolutely doesn't matter. And honestly, if you think what it should look like is just a compressed pile of nothing, because that means that what's been delivered from your website was as efficient as possible, as compressed, which, you know, is less space and which means it loads faster. I agree.
You should always probably be serving minified cached HTML, CSS, and JavaScript to anything. So I wouldn't worry about the output. I do know what you're talking about, though, Rick. Like, and part of it is because like Google Chrome's view source treats tabs as 8 space characters or something like ridiculous like that. So it gets like really extreme. So while on yours, you were just like, oh yeah, I hit tab and then it's like 2 spaces. And then Google Chrome's like, bah, psych, tabs are now 8 spaces and you can't change it. So, that's, I've felt like your thing in the past, but I wouldn't worry about generated output. As far as like coding, I personally switched recently to soft tabs, two spaces always, because it's kind of standard. Like I know a lot of people who do it. But also if you're going to like a white space significant, language like Python or if you're using like the old school SAS syntax, the SASS syntax, those are all white space sensitive. And so if you're just like, you know, just injecting tabs, like you can start having problems really fast. So that's my input.
Totally. I'm a high fives on two spaces. I just like two spaces. If you're working on, you know, like a project, make sure that your other people are on board with that too. Have a little meeting about that. In Sublime Text too, it is really good at being able to switch between, like if you grab a file that isn't, just at the bottom there's a little thing. It allows you to pick spaces or tabs and how many spaces, and it just gets that whole thing rocking and rolling in whatever your choice is. It's better, I think, than the TextMate version of it. I'm sure there's other things. I feel like it really excels at getting things into the right shape.
Yep. There's a lot of cool plugins for Sublime too that'll like show you how many tabs and where you're at and your indentation. It's cool.
I want to look those up. Anyway, I'm not going to go too much into that. But if you're, some projects have standards for this type of thing. If you're going to, hack on somebody else's project, just use what they use. You know, don't be like, mm-hmm. Oh, spaces are better. You know, anyway, be adaptable in this little bit. And you were talking about WordPress, Rick, and how it's WordPress isn't screwing up your indentation. I promise you that unless you're using some like plugin that is messing with your markup, like a caching plugin of some kind, your indentation is what you made it. So remember that, okay, so let's say your WordPress theme starts in your header.php file, which has your doc type and head and all that stuff in it, and then you like open some kind of page wrap div or whatever, and you got some indentation started, and then you move into your like loop.php file or whatever, that wherever you have to start that file as indented as far as you started in the header.php file, if you're really interested in making sure that there's a consistent view source experience. You know what I mean? Like you can't just start everything aligned left again. That's what's making your indentation look weird, is that you have to kind of follow where you were at.
And I would maybe argue, like if you start like your file indented, like your loop.php or something, you know, just a little snippet indented like 12 tabs, like that's probably actually less usable for your team or even yourself. I think you just maybe have to surrender the like absolute control of the spit out markup, especially when we're using processors and all that to stitch pages together. I think I just let it go, man.
Let it go. I totally agree. Who cares about view source? Make sure it is readable for yourself and probably compressed anyways. All right. Okay. We got one by Nathan. Or wait, where are we?
Yeah, there. And then next, we have one from Nathan Coop. This is great, guys. All right. As a web developer, non-designer, my CSS skills are lacking. I understand the basics of display block versus inline, but I generally just Google endlessly and fiddle around in Firebug until the page looks fine. I love that. Are there any good tutorials for developers to improve CSS skills? P.S. Canada loves the show. P.P.S. just wanted to let you know that .NET guys also care about design. .NET guys care about design, this changes everything. Thanks. And thank you, Canada. We really appreciate you.
You nailed here. That. We appreciate you.
Great job.
Okay.
So what do we say around here when somebody says, I work on stuff and I'm looking to get better at stuff? What should I work on next? Just build websites.
I'm trying to... We need to theme song for you, man.
Nathan, you need to get an idea for a website you want to build, and then you should build it. And then you'll automatically get better, because that's how practicing works. One of the ways I first got into learning CSS and getting better at it was WordPress. I would install it, and then I'd find a pre-built theme, and I would put it in there, and I would alter it. And I'd be like, I want to put this here. So I would open up the CSS file and change it around and learn it, or I would go to a website and try to copy it, because I'd be like, this website's awesome, so I'm going to try to figure out how they did it and just kind of build it from scratch with CSS. I think you're doing good. If you already know what Firebug is and tinkering around and that type of stuff, you're on the right track to get better at CSS. You just got to write more of it.
Yeah, I would say there's a lot of like design for developers resources out there, which are rad. But ultimately, I sort of think like design and development are two different sides of the brain, like two separate skills. And I would even put like front end development to be like in between those two separate skills. So it's like rides the middle of the brain. Like I'm not much of a designer, but like I'll practice a lot. Which is basically me like breaking out Photoshop or Fireworks, and like I just start laying out a page or tinkering or whatever. But I would do that. Like just start laying stuff out, because the part of design is like proportion and layout and spacing. And like once you lock into what that means, like you're going to get 80 to 90% of the way there. Like in terms of good design. So I would ask, like do that, like lay out a page, then ask a true designer what he or she thinks, and then like just go back and fix everything they said was wrong and try again. You'd be surprised like how much practice and public humiliation will make you better. Yeah, basically they're great motivators. So public humiliation for the win.
Yay.
Can I make that my theme song? Okay.
Public humiliation, FDW.
Good. Yeah,
that's an important aspect, though, I think. Of you got to get over the scareds.
Yeah, well, yeah. And so ask designers, too. I ask Reagan Ray at work all the time. I'm just like, hey, I made this. And he's like, cool. Let me help you. So it helps, dude. It really works. It really works.
Fact.
Okay, boom. Next one, Chris.
Jay Morgan says, boilerplate. What is it? What is the best way to use it? I've looked into it a bit, and I want to find a good starting point for my projects, but I don't know exactly where to go with that. By boilerplate, he means the HTML5 boilerplate by Divya Manian and previous Shop Talk show guest Paul Irish. What is the HTML5 boilerplate?
Well, the HTML5 boilerplate is a collection of best front-end practices, and it's basically like a starter kit. You just like download it, crack it open, and it's got like a really good base for like making a website and all that CSS stuff that you see. Like if you can go through it line by line, but like it's basically stuff you're going to end up putting in your project anyway. Like, and so
there was a funny post. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. So it's kind of like, I don't know. It's you look up the definition of boilerplate, I guess. It's like a template that has very little in it. So how you would start using it is you would just download the thing, which literally there's a button at html5boilerplate.com or whatever it's at, and you download it, and it downloads a folder to your desktop, and you would like just make that folder the root of the next project that you work on. It has an index file in it and all that stuff. There's a whole bunch of code in it. It links to some CSS files and stuff. Just, you know, use that as the base of your HTML and CSS and stuff for whatever your new project is. That's how you use it. It's pretty easy to use that way. Dave has a video link here, which is Paul Irish talking about it.
Yeah, it's like he just basically runs down what's in it, and you know, it's just stuff like there's like a CSS reset, but now I think that it uses normalize,
right?
So which is rad. So you just have to like kind of be like, oh, okay,
there's all this
so that's
stuff
what it's
in
doing.
The head that you're gonna forget to put in there. Mm-hmm. That's important that you should put in there. It has an HTXS boilerplate that has like caching stuff in it that you'll forget to put on your website, but you won't forget now because you're using this. And it has links to like that you should have an image that is for when people save your website to the iPhone and what's the template for that image so that you can open that, edit it, save it back to your project, and now you won't forget about that because it's been a part of this boilerplate. It's all these little things that you'll probably forget about, but you won't if you use this. So that's kind of the idea. I honestly use it as a reference more than I use the download it and start with that folder thing. I usually just look through it and make sure that I've addressed the things that it addresses. Mm-hmm. I would say I read this funny article the other day, and it's just one of those like pseudo call out moments, but I'm not going to do that. But it was this article that's like, we use too much of this stuff. There's too much helper stuff these days that we're forgetting how to take it back to the basics and write it. And it was like, I don't use HTML5 boilerplate. It's too much stuff in there. Here's my HTML5 boilerplate. And it's just like a doc type, a head and a body, and that's it. You know what I mean? Like, just there's nothing in there. And then there was a comment below it that was like, yeah, you tell them. Also, you know, I don't use HTML5 boilerplate easy. I just use it. I'm old school like that. Also, you forgot the language attribute on your HTML tag, which makes it invalid based on this accessibility standard. And it was this really funny comment because they were like, rah, 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 you're right. Screw HTML5 boilerplate. The point of this article wasn't screw HTML boilerplate, but it was like, we don't, you know what I mean? It was like, we don't need all this.
Yeah.
And then they pointed out this tiny little thing that she forgot that makes it invalid. That's what HTML5 boilerplate is all about. It's not forgetting little things like that, because you will, because there's starting to be too many of them.
Yeah.
It was funny. It was like it was both, you know, both screw HTML by boilerplate and wow, look how useful HTML in one.
Yeah.
Comment.
Yep.
Anyway.
No. Yeah. I think download it, crack it open. And then in the CSS, there's like this little portion that says author styles. That's where you just start writing, Jay. You just start riffing.
There you go. There you go. And you may find there's more in there than you need. That's a common criticism. And then if you really know what you're doing and you've decided that you don't need this part of HTML4 blank, just take it out.
Yep.
No one. It's not a crime.
Use it like five Next times question. And then you know what you're doing. So boom. Next question. This is from Euros Zurich. He's asking, my question would be fairly simple, and I can imagine how many people wonder the same thing. When you are starting as a web designer or developer and you know the basics like HTML and CSS and have the ability to put out great design concepts, what is the best way to attract clients? Ta-da! Oh, I got a ta-da! Okay, so I know that most of it is work, 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 but what do you do when you don't have clients to start with? Any tips how to get to spotlight so people can see your cool stuff? Thanks.
He says right here, I has the ability to put out great design concepts. If you have that ability, Euros, that means that you have what it takes to build a good portfolio for yourself. So you have this proof that what you do is good work. You said it so yourself. I believe you. Yes. Now you have this portfolio. And so you use that then. So you could go to something like Authentix Jobs, which posts people that are looking for a freelancer to help them out with your project. You email that person with this portfolio that you've built, which is your proof that you are an excellent designer, and you will find work, believe me. Yeah. Or put itself out there. I am available for hire. I feel like in this thing, you know, we're in this down economy or whatever. I don't want to talk about politics because I don't know anything about politics, but I hear that constantly about how awful the economy is. I find in the world of web design development, it's impossible to hire the right people. If you are any good in this, believe me, you can get a job. And if you can't in your market and you're able to move, please move to Silicon Valley where I live, because they are constantly hiring people. They need people. They need freelancers. They need full-time employees. They need contractors. They need everybody. If you are a good designer, you can find work. In this world, absolutely, believe me, especially if you have an excellent portfolio, like I'm sure you do, Euros.
Yeah, if you have, like, it doesn't hurt to get on Dribbble and put shots up of your design. And then, like Chris was saying, build a portfolio website. It's so, like, cliche and terrible, but, like, do that, and then put your dribbles on your portfolio website. Just do it. I think you can't hurt yourself to have that.
Mark yourself as hireable on Dribbble, so they can find you that way.
Yeah.
And post on, you know, get involved on Twitter, whatever. If you're good and you're available, oh, my God, will you get snatched up, man.
Yeah. you might be working at Facebook. If you do cool stuff, like, people will see it, and like, don't, like, you know, beg for tweets and retweets. Like, it's honestly, like, let it be organic. Like, if you're doing cool stuff, people take notice. By all means,
and if you don't get any attention, you're maybe not as good as you think you are. So, I don't know you personally. I hope you are, but seriously, like, yeah, it wasn't a burn. It was, just kind of saying, you know, like, if you did all this stuff and you're like, you're just lying. I put my stuff on Dribbble and I didn't get any attention. I was, you know, well, that's the kind of sad side of Dribbble is, you know, it kind of can give you that negative feedback as well.
Well, and
I get that feedback on Dribbble. I have a Dribbble account and nobody likes my stuff because I'm not a very good designer.
Hey, it happens. I feel the same way. Like, Trent's on the front page every time he, like, puts a picture of his kid up, and I try really hard. But anyway, yeah. Also, you can, like, submit sites you've made, or even just your portfolio site to, like, CSS galleries. That's a great way. Like, that's a tried and true way of, like, people seeing it. I know I've subscribed to, like, 4 or 5 CSS galleries, so I'd probably see it. And attend conferences and meetups. I know tons of people who are super talented who I've only, like, met through that. Like I would have never found out about them without meeting them in person. So that's another thing you can do. We say that a lot, don't we? I'm going to make that my new mantra. Attend conferences and meetups. That's my new mantra. Hey, well. Here we go. Okay, shall we go to the next question?
Sure. Or
did you have something to say?
No, I'm done.
Okay, boom. Next question is from Jason Kendall. Do you want to read this, Chris?
I will. My question is regarding to setting margins, paddings, heights, using pixels or M's. I've seen some sites that will set padding, margins, and height on some elements with pixels, and then on the same site, some elements using M's. Is there a reason you would use pixels sometimes and M's is the other? Or is it okay to use M's for everything? So normally you think of M's with font size, right? And he's saying not font size, but margins, paddings, and heights. First of all, hopefully everybody knows that you can do that. M's is just another, is like PX. It's just EM in CSS, and it's just another possible measurement. And M, I think, it's like an old school print technique that I think it's like equal to the width of literally a capital M or something like that. Yep. I'm not sure if it maps that cleanly anymore in the world.
No, of digital, it's a little different, but yeah. Like, okay. It used to be this box you could draw around an M character. So,
yeah. Okay. So, but it's width. It's kind of like, you know, it's based on width, even though you can set a height with it.
Mm-hmm.
At least in the digital world. Anyway, it's pretty cool. There's some big, big supporters of M's. And the reason you used to use it is because setting pixels in CSS for font size wouldn't allow you to, when you bumped up, it would like lock into that pixel size in older versions of Internet Explorer. That's not a big concern anymore. So if you're setting fonts and pixels, I wouldn't worry about that too much. Most sites are using the page zoom thing, which is just kind of better anyway. But M's still have a place in this world. I feel like I recently read an article that really made a strong case for using them for font size still, but then also kind of extended into using it for margin size. The deal is, it's nice. I have a friend who only uses M's for all this stuff, margins, padding, sites, and everything, is a big fan of it because of the like mental connection that starts to happen in your head when those types of things are related to type. So you're like, there's just a stronger connection between setting the font size in it and then also using it for margins and paddings and heights and widths and stuff. There's like a, I don't know, just more gel or something to your designs. It's all kind of arbitrary anyway, isn't it? Like who, you might as well use M's. I mean, whatever, as long as you're, I would say the worst mistake is like what you said, you've seen JSON, which is combining the two things. I would not cross the streams in that way. I would pick pixels or M's or, I don't know, anything but points, I guess, because they're kind of a wreck. But why mix it up? It's confusing, and you're not getting all the benefit of M's if you're messing around.
Yeah.
That was...
Oh, I was going to say, we use M's like pretty standard at Paravel. It can get super complicated when you have M units within M units but I would say it's like worth figuring out.
Because they cascade, right?
Yeah.
So if you have font size 1.1 on your UL and a font size 1.1 on your LI, and they're nested within each other, it will kind of nest and it will be bigger than 1.1. It'll be like 1 point bigger.
Yeah, like 10% bigger. So it gets weird. Or 11%? I don't know. It gets weird. So, but there are like M calculators which can help you figure out like how it's cascading. And it's totally worth figuring out. Like whether or not you use them in life, like I feel like that's a web developer skill you have to have. So I would say spend a weekend going, ouch, figure it out. One cool thing, like you talked about consistency and design, Chris, but like if you like have a paragraph that's 1M, you know, your font size is 1M, and then you add margin bottom 1M, it'll basically, your vertical baseline rhythm is going to stay consistent. And so, Jason, that's like a really, like baselines are super sexy and typographers just think they're the coolest.
That makes a lot of sense.
It'll be way easier and to manage, and like you're just going to have like a consistent flow and throughout your whole document if you just stick with them. I used to just be like, oh, F it, I'm using pixels because it's easier and I get like exact control. But like if you're going to make the move in the next half decade to responsive web design, like having everything in M units will save you like a million headaches along the road. So just because like when your body copies changes, you want all your padding to probably be again, like consistent to that vertical rhythm. So it saves you lots of time in the future.
There you go. Dave's a big fan of M's.
I like M's.
Good to know.
Also, you can do like percentage padding. That's like extreme responsive web design margining, but don't worry about that yet. It's cool because like you get like super tight for like a phone, which is probably what it should be, but you know, but yeah, you gotta.
It's all the more. I always scared of that because there's all the. That like sub pixel rendering with percentages is off a little bit in some browsers. So the more you do, the more percentages there are, the more off it is in the browsers that are off. So if you have like one column that's 50% and another column that's 50%, you won't have much problems. But if you have three columns and all of them are 20.2% with a padding of 1.8%, there's just all these little, like, it's going to be wrong that much many more times in the one width across.
Yeah.
Which is one reason I like the box sizing thing.
Again, yeah. And that's.
And the M's might be good for that.
Yeah, totally. Anyway,
there's rems too. Be aware of that. If Dave's mentioned the problem with nesting M's within M's, rem, which is relative, M is relative to the root, which is probably the body in most cases, unless you don't set in the body and do set in the HTML, but that's a tangent. You'll probably set the font size in the body. Everywhere you use rem then will reference what you've set on the body, which is a nice thing, and it's getting more support, so you have to worry about that nesting problem less.
Yeah, that's advanced too. Yeah, it's good. Think about it. Well, cool.
I saw a pretty cool less mix in for REMS. It's like I want to use it, but I want to do all the fallbacks. You just like whatever.
Oh,
it's a good.
Sweet.
It's a nice preprocessor thing. Okay, let's move on though. Louis Grodzki, you got this one, Dave. You want to shoot the gun too?
Hold on, I can do it. Louis Grodzki. Hey guys, I'm recently I'm into progressive enhancement and mobile first principle. What I'm trying to do is set up my HTML CSS template. Again, he's like writing his own boilerplate. That's cool. and how that would work. I borrow a bit of snippets from here and there, the boilerplate and then hard-boiled CSS. And he has two questions. How many CSS style sheets do you recommend to use? Is it wise to have external query conditions or internal? And he goes here, he describes his like style sheets. Like he has a basic.css, like link rel style sheet, basic.css.
That would be loaded on everything.
Everything. And then he has a link rel media only screen and min width 320 and min max width 480. And that goes.
So these are links that would be in the head of your document and how you can use media queries within the style sheets you load inside your head.
And that's like a thing you can do. That's like, this is totally legal.
So, it's legit, yeah.
Yeah. So, and so he's just basically like loading a smartphone CSS for in between 320, 480. 481 to 1024 is a tablet CSS. 1025 to 1823 is desktop. And so like, he just kind of like keeps growing it and then, you know, injects a style sheet.
He's saying, is this a good idea? And this is what he would call, I believe, an external conditions rather than internal. And internal meaning within a single style sheet, you can use the syntax at media space and then list these same media queries and combine all these. He has four listed here as links. You could combine them all into one. Which is kind of a better approach, I believe he's asking. Is that right?
Yeah, yeah. So, and this is probably a hot drama situation, but there you go.
I would say it's not hot drama because, and I'll tell you why. This is four HTTP requests. This the way he has it written here, the browser will request all four of these things, regardless of the media query that he's written here. All four of these will be downloaded no matter what. Which is a little bit too bad. You might think, oh, but can't the browser tell that my browser is very thin and I don't need this desktop? I mean, narrow. It absolutely doesn't need this desktop CSS. Well, it just, I mean, for better or worse, there's some reasons for it, I believe, but it just doesn't work that way. It will download your desktop CSS anyway. And because all browsers will download all copies of this, you're making four HTTP requests instead of one. So I just think for sure it's just automatically worse.
That's, you know,
you might as well. Yeah.
Oh no. You don't want to ever like force a browser to download stuff it's not going to use. Well, but then again, I'm going to advocate internal. I feel like if you use internal, you're still embracing this cascading principle as, you know, things get bigger. Now you just override this, you know, and that's, if you're doing true mobile first, that's just how it goes. I know 320 and up advocates these like separate style sheets, but I'm not much of a fan.
Is it really? That seems weird. There's some cleanness to keeping separate files. I could see that being nice in development and in your mind and cleanliness. But that's kind of irrelevant because what you could do is just use an import statement within your internal media queries. So you could keep them separate anyway. And you can also pre-process them together. So that's not a big concern. I don't know why it would advocate using this, because I generally, every time I see these, I'm like, eh, gross. Put them all in one. Because your caching is going to be better. And the number of HTTP requests is especially important on mobile devices. It's just going to be slower doing it this way. And here's the thing: is what's in these like bonus media query files isn't all that much stuff. Probably,
right?
It's not like you're starting from scratch. It's not like these, like you have a 40K style sheet and each one of the rest of these is a totally different 40K of CSS. It's not. It's probably a few lines where you're shifting some things around. Or if it's not, do you have a really good reason why it's not? Or, you know, could you clean that up?
Yeah, I think for me, I when I write media queries, it's usually just like 5 to 10 lines of code. Like, it's really not much. I usually just change the body font size or something like that. Or I switch something from float to like no float or
whatever.
Yeah. And I would also be careful like with the mental model you're creating. Like, tablet.css, like, it makes sense right now. But, like, when you look at, like, phones like the Galaxy Tab or something, where it's, like, this weird phone slash tablet, it's, like, as big as, like, you know, I don't, it's, like, half the size of an iPad, but it's, like, also dials your mother. I mean, you know, what is it? You know, is it a phone or a tablet? And that's like how they're advertising it. So I think it's best to break the device mentality, like when you're working in responsive and mobile first. And
I agree. What just, do you do though? What do you call those files? Or do you just not call them anything because they're internal and they don't need a name?
Yeah, they're just internal. So you just, I mean, like, I'll like make a comment and just be like, you know, this is, I'll do like at 620 pics, and then I'll maybe say like iPad single column, just as like a note, just to be like,
yeah,
this is what why I'm writing this or something. Just to kind of like, cause some people are like, you know, you may not be immediate, like what you're looking for. And it's easier to search for iPad, like Command F and find iPad, you know, in my doc than it is to like find 320 pics or something. Cause that'll be like 400 times. So,
right.
That's sort of my deal. And then this is a two-part question. So, what is the best way to have responsive images? Goodness gracious. This is a big question. Chris.
Yeah. That's one of these ones that I was like, this is like even more of a brave new frontier than touch and responsive design and all that stuff is what, how do we deal with the media that is within these websites? Because on a small, I'm about to publish an article on this because I've been thinking about it, and we're in this really weird area right now where there's no really awesome solution. I have a blog post I just published about icon fonts. There's 2.9 megabytes worth of images on the whole, not just worth of image. The whole page is that big. That's a very large page. It's too big in general for a web page to be 2.9 megabytes. Too large. So when I tweeted that article, I almost felt like putting an asterisk on it and saying, warning, if you're on like Edge Network, don't click this link. Just star it and read it when you get home, because I don't want to be responsible for this web page taking forever for you to load. But I was like, but I didn't just screw up. I wanted to have a whole bunch of screenshots in there because that's the point of this resource. Anyway, ideally, I could have made that page with these really big images on it. But I wouldn't have to put that asterisk on the tweet. It would just, there would be some technology going on which would take these somewhat large images and make them much smaller in case you were on a browser with a very narrow screen, probably a mobile device, so that it wouldn't be 2.9 megabytes. Maybe we could get it down to 1 megabyte or even smaller, ideally, or something like that. That's what I would think of when he's saying responsive images. Now, he might just be saying, well, how do you get images to resize? Well, if you just have an image and you want it to fit into your fluid column, you might just put max width 100%, height auto important, and just call it a day, because that will get it to resize. But it doesn't deal with the problem of that image being too big for the screen that it needs to be on. Ideally, it would serve a smaller, lower resolution images in those situations, or if you're on perhaps a desktop device that has extremely good bandwidth, that you serve a great high res image, or you're on the iPad 3, which needs really good images in order to look good, all these type of things. That's what's going on in the world of responsive images today, and it's a bit of a quagmire. And my blog post is going to cover some of this stuff, being like, do we need a new element, or do we need a new format for images that can kind of handshake with the server and serve the right version of itself? That way it keeps the syntax clean, does the right thing. There's lots of different ways. There's JavaScript ways to deal with it. It's just, I don't know what to tell you, man.
No, it's a hot mess. There's not a best practice yet, but that doesn't mean we shouldn't try stuff. So right. I personally like the ideas of machines solving this problem. So I put one image somewhere and then machines fix it for me, you know.
Yes.
Which
so Christopher Schmidt, a blog post that agrees with you recently on ChristopherSchmidt.com or org or something, just saying the picture element, which you may have dabbled with or seen that Scott Gell has this fallback for, is cool and it gives us lots of power and it kind of solves the problem for us, but it's also very complicated. mm-hmm. in a way. And it's not the machine solving the problem for you. It's making four different versions of that image and all this type of stuff. And he's saying, if we could just keep using Imj with a format that would deal with it for us, or some kind of technology that would deal with it for us, that's ideal.
Yeah.
And I in the middle of the road.
Yeah. Well, I like the picture. I said that in episode 10, let's say. I am a big fan of Scott Gell. And so I like the picture element. I do. But having worked recently a lot with audio and video elements, even on Chop Talk, like having multiple sources is the worst thing on the planet, dude. It's just, it's so like bleeping annoying. It's like, I'd rather be just punched in the face just over.
You got to build them. I mean, I could see, you know, people that use WordPress, maybe you upload it through their media uploader and then some magical stuff happens in the background where it makes different versions of itself and saves them down. And then when you insert it into your post, it just gives you the syntax for free. That's fine, but not very few, you know, we don't all work like that. I write most HTML with my hands, you know.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, no,
it's just it won't be used enough. And his argument is that we just won't do it. If picture is what we're going to get, some people will use it, but most people won't. It's just too much work. We just won't do it.
Yeah. There's this adaptive-images.com. It looks like it's like a PHP script that does a cookie once and then it's like set up and it'll give you, in theory, the right size image for the resolution. It's cool, but that's more the end I want to go. But then that's got a PHP dependency, blah blah blah, but like that's the direction I want to go. It's just like I want a robot to do this for me. This is a robot problem. Anyway,
dang, this dude is kind of goth. All the photos on adaptive images are like dark forests, like girls with nose piercings and stuff.
Yeah, yeah, totally. It's like girl from Tim Burton movie or
whatever. Yeah.
Anyway, well, sweet. I feel like
I forgot about this. This is pretty good. This is kind of what we want, though, right? Where we don't have to make I know this is a lot of setup, but if this was how the world worked and we didn't have to do any work, this would be all right.
And there is Sentia.io. has like this image or img.sentia.io or something, and that's cool too. But again, you're like putting all your money on one platform. Good luck with that. But like, but it's I've heard
well,
it
if
like
self-host it. They should open source it.
Yeah, I hear it kind of fails at some point. But would I just like be like images.daverupert.com and send all my images through that? Heck yeah, I would. Heck yeah, I would. Anyway, that's something to think about. So I'm going to call that one dead. All right. Next one, Chris.
Nathan Greenstein. One thing that tripped me up while making small sites is creating navigation bars that are easy to maintain. Small meaning not a lot of pages, I guess. Ideally, I would have a single file that I can update with new pages and have the changes propagate to each page where the nav bar is shown without having to upload a new version of those pages to the server. Is there a nice way to do this, maybe with server-side includes or a PHP script? Absolutely, Nathan. If I were to have a website and there was even two pages on it that had the exact same navigation on it, I would already be annoyed with myself if that navigation code was repeated on those two pages. I would be like, no, that's what code is for, and I will fix this problem so that way when I only have to update that navigation in one place. That's just front-end dev 101 stuff there. So, Nathan, that is an excellent question. Yes, you should absolutely do it that way. And you mentioned PHP, so the PHP way to handle that would just be to use the include function that PHP has, and just and it takes one parameter, so parentheses, and then put within quotes the name of the file that you want to include, or the file path, and then the name of the file that you want to include, and it will just grab the contents of that file and put it onto the page that you are working on, so that if you have these two pages with the same navigation, you put this PHP little bit of PHP on both of those two pages, and you have your navigation Echo. Did I understand that correctly? Is that what you took from this, Dave?
Yeah, totally. Like, he just wants, if you're repeating yourself, this is a good thing. It's called the DRY principle.
DRY.
Don't repeat yourself. So if you find yourself coding anything over and over and over and over, like, just break it out into like a little snippet, you know, a little block of code.
Every time. That's the trick to DRY. Yeah. Every time.
Yeah. And like, I use a lot of like, for these small sites, like he's talking about, just little brochure sites you're putting up. Like, just, I do a lot of like header.php and footer.php. It works, like, it gets you 98% of the way there. There's like few things like if you want to change the title tag or something, like, you got to grok it a little bit and add variables and all that, but it's totally doable. And it's probably just how most of the internet works. I mean, WordPress mostly works like that. So,
yeah, right. There's like a header.php in WordPress themes, so that you don't have to repeat that code in the different templates. It's just all the files use it, and you know, it does it in slightly different ways. You know, the function in WordPress is just called get header, and it basically just does an include of that file. It does it in a more, it's just a slightly different syntax, just so it sounds like English, I guess. Every single processor framework has some ability to do includes like this in any language. If you don't have the ability or don't want to run PHP or run Ruby or Python or any framework like that on your website, you literally want it to be brochure-like and then it's just like this HTML-only website, you could use a preprocessor for HTML like Jade. Jade has the ability to do includes in its syntax, and it will grab file and pre-process it. And then, so if you wanted to, Jade has a syntax for that, which is nice. Like, Haml is a part of Rails, so Rails does the include, but Haml by itself can't do an include. I don't know about Slim, but that's one of the cool reasons to use Jade, in my opinion. I've used it a number of times, specifically only because of its ability to pre-process includes.
That's cool.
All right, Nathan, good question.
Good.
Let's move.
Question. Check, check. Okay, next one's David Barrera. He's got a question about code editors. Hey, you've talked a lot about the best text editors. TextMate, Sublime, etc. And now I'm using this for my little projects. But big problem for me that I have with all of them, when I need to make some PHP stuff, they don't give me any kind of error messages back. I tried some months before NetBeans, but like NetBeans 7.0.1, but it was big and slow, and it gave me a lot of information about errors, misspellings, that stuff that drives me crazy about the other editors. What do you think about it? So he's kind of saying like these big systems that give you like super, they like almost hover over your code and they like validate
IDEs,
it.
IDEs, they're generally called.
Yeah,
right?
IDEs. And then these text editors, which is like TextMate, that's just a glorified Notepad, more or less, right?
Exactly.
Do you got any feedback for this, Chris?
Kinda. I mean, I've written a good amount of PHP in my life, but I'm not really a back-end developer. That's just like Captain PHP to the point that. Anyway, I've only ever used Coda, TextMate, and Sublime pretty much in my professional career as a coder, and I've never really felt the need to write PHP in anything else. If you write PHP, you write a little bit, you save it, you go to the browser, you refresh the page. If you have some kind of error messaging turned on, and if there's a problem, it will tell you it's a problem. Or it will just fail if you don't have error reporting turned on, and you can go back and look at the code that you just wrote and try to find the error. I realize that's a little ghetto to some people. I would say that but it works. I mean, I've never, I've made a career out of it, so... I would say things like NetBeans are for two people. They're for people that are just starting, because they want to, the syntax is such a big deal when you're just starting that they want to be informed of syntax problems immediately. And this is syntax beyond just missing a quote or whatever. Because if you just miss a quote, you know, TextMate, the highlighting will be wrong, and that's your clue that something is wrong. But NetBeans will go farther than that, I think. I can't think of a super good example, but it'll check your code more deeply than TextMate or something like Sublime will. So for beginners, and then probably like hardcore guys, you know, that all they do is write PHP all day, and they dig into some of NetBeans' deeper features, can probably make more use of it. But like really like mediocre guys like me that just dabble around in a little PHP, I don't need it. I have no desire to run a full IDE, especially as you say, it's big and slow.
Yeah, for me. For me, like the text editors I use, and I use all the ones you mentioned, Chris, but they have really great autocomplete, like syntax modules and stuff like that. So it's like you just start typing, like you just go preg, and then it's like preg replace or preg insert or preg baby. I don't know. It's just all these like options, and then you just like, you know, tab or scroll down to the one you want, and then it'll tell you what you need to fill that out. And so I rely on that a lot to like make my code be right, you know. Then most of them should have also like PHP validation plugins. I know like Coda has one, you just have to Google for it. I know, in TextMate, you can like hit Command R and run the file you're working on, and it should kind of bark at you or spit out what you're looking for. You'll have to like maybe tinker with it and set it up, but it's not like a whole weekend worth of effort. It's just like a, you know, like Google something and then figure it out. Just grok it.
Is NetBeans free? I mean,
I don't know. I don't know.
To see. I think they probably have a free. No, it's free, it looks like. Oh, yeah, well, it's just super gross. It's one of those websites that has the software in a box in 3D.
Oh, cool.
Because so, that like looks like software, you know?
All right, yeah.
I love that.
I want to buy it now. Yeah, that's weird. there are like a lot of the Java dudes have to use IDEs and stuff like that, and Eclipse is like a famous one, and you can code PHP or Ruby in Eclipse, but gosh darn it, it's a little painful. So good luck doing that. I mean, and they're really robust environments, but they're like, I think if you're just wanting to go fast and loose, then a text editor is probably your thing. But you know, if your boss is like, you make errors all the time, then like maybe just slow it down. So there you go. That's my advice. Sound good, Chris?
That sounds so good.
Boom. Next one. This one's from Edgar Lopez. Edgar's asking, how much? Oh, you want it? Yeah, take it. You take
no,
it.
No, I don't.
This one's about cash money.
How much should I ask for a salary if a company wants to hire me? The question is because a company of web development is hiring, but I think they are very cheap, or maybe it is just me. Cheap meaning they may have maybe made him an offer that is under what he's worth, possibly. For a little extra information here, in this company I'll be working with PHP, MySQL, JavaScript, CSS, jQuery. Look at a really across guy. You're just going to do front end and back end, which is certainly worth extra bucks, if you ask me. He says, I hope you can tell me an estimate in dollars. Mm-hmm. Well, that's an interesting question. I don't think we should shy away from talking about money on this show. He says that, well, you know, it depends on a bunch of stuff. You know, we can't just say, well, you work with PHP, MySQL, JavaScript, CSS, and jQuery. That's worth exactly $71,000 per year. You know, like I can't do that for you because it depends on factors. It depends on exactly what your job is. So it sounds like you're worried. Like, are you really? Do you really? need to do all of those things, or are they considering it more of a front-end or back-end job? That matters, because usually back-end developers make more money than designers do, in my experience. Not, you know, front-end, you know, probably goes basically like back-end, front-end designers, which is, you know, however you feel about that. In my experience, that's how the kind of the pay scale goes, which is too bad. I was thinking about doing a blog post about this one time, but I wasn't prepared for the backlash, but I feel like maybe developers at junior levels should make a little bit more money, but at the upper echelon, I feel like design is at least equally important, if not worth more. Because I think talented designers are harder to come by and worth more to the company. Anyway, that's a rabbit hole. So what your job is matters. That's the first factor. The second factor is where it is. That's a big deal because of cost of living and stuff like that. And the supply and demand of developers in your area. And what your experience level is, that being probably one of the most important things. If you're a junior developer, certainly you will make less money than a senior developer. Those titles just meaning like literally how many years of experience do you have doing this, and were you able to rise the ranks, as it were, at previous jobs, if there are such a thing. So factoring in all those three things will be what your salary is. For fun, the people that do a list apart, an event apart, and a book apart, and all that thing, do like a survey apart. I think they just call it the A List Apart survey. They did one in 2011, and now it's 2012, and as far as I could tell, they have not yet published the 2011 results from that survey, but they have published the 2010 results, which are pretty interesting. It's a very long survey, and they do all they can to get everybody in the industry to fill this thing out, so you may have remembered it. And there's some parts in there about salary. And you can just look at the chart yourself. I was going to try to explain the chart, but I can say that the highest bar in that chart, which is something like 25% of the people, make somewhere between $40,000 and $60,000 as a developer. But then there was more people higher than that. So more than 50% of people make more than between the $40,000 to $60,000 range. Hmm. That was a part of it. Do you have some other resources?
Yeah, well, there's this site called indeed.com and then /salary, indeed.com/salary. And basically it's just a job board and it has various, you know, positions. So you just type in your job title, like web developer or whatever, and then your location, like your zip code, or the zip code you're being offered a job, and click view salary. And you can get an idea of like what people are offering for salaries in whatever market. So it's a pretty powerful tool. I use that whenever I want to determine my self-worth.
Typing web designer, Austin, Texas, $54,000, the average in Austin, Texas. I'm going to type Palo Alto, California, $78,000. I just sort of got it. Did a second ago, and it was 80. It must.
It can change pretty dramatically. Like, but yeah. So like, there you go. But there's like two numbers, right, you can go off.
$20,000 difference in between Dave's city and mine. I'm sure we both have no idea how much each other make, and we might as well leave it at that. I think in general, talking about exact salary is a little – it doesn't bode well.
It doesn't do anyone any good. If you're a junior dev, like, adjust your price accordingly. You know, like, whether that's 10%, I don't even know, dude. Just adjust it maybe a bit lower than what the region is asking. And then, you know, you probably shouldn't be making mad cash, like freaking swimming pools of cash, when you're just getting out of college. But like Chris was saying, like, earlier, I think you were saying, Chris, like, for what it's worth, like, devs are in super demand right now. So if they're, like, kind of crunching your pennies, if you will, it would be easy to change the situation. So there you go.
It sure would. I can tell you from a little bit of experience, I live in Silicon Valley now, which is just, there's just every other house is some kind of startup or something. Everybody's trying to hire people. Most of my experience in this is through front end development. So that's the kind of jobs I'm most familiar with. If you are demonstrably decent at it and can come in and we can ask you questions like, can you absolutely what's the difference between relative and absolute positioning? And you have no problem answering simple questions like that, and have a little bit of a resume that says that you've done this before for companies or whatever. You're very, very hireable anywhere in Silicon Valley, and you're going to make more than $100,000 a year. You might start at 120 at some job just with that kind of skill. I'm not even kidding. You know, if that shocks you or anything, and you want to make that kind of money, and don't now, make sure your chops are up in front end dev and move to Silicon Valley, because but at the same time, be aware that the rents here are ridiculous. So yeah, a lot of that money is immediately getting rethrown away into where you're living. So that's why those salaries are higher. It's a supply and demand situation, also cost of living. So.
And your company might not be around in a year. So there you go.
That's absolutely. I mean, fortunately, you can just bounce. But
anyway. Yep. But yeah, interesting. So there you go, Edgar. Hopefully that'll help you out. And
I hope you make more than 40, though, Edgar. You deserve it for listening to Shop Doc Show. I think if they're offering you less than $40,000 and you know PHP, MySQL, JavaScript, CSS, and jQuery, you certainly deserve more than $40,000 a year. Okay, Josh Higgins.
Josh Higgins.
Hey, guys. I was wondering, when you guys find inspiration online, how do you guys kind of categorize that or save that? Because right now I have, 200-something bookmarks in my Firefox, and I was wondering if you knew of a system to easily sort those and search through those when you're working on a project.
Oh yeah. Josh, I got nothing for you, man. I'm about the same. I have like a billion bookmarks, and I've recently tried to start pulling them out of my browser and into something I'd use, New Delicious. And so that's just working better for me because my browser's less crowded, and you can tag a lot better. I don't know if there's a real great way. I used to watch like 80 projects on GitHub, but then it was just a nightmare. My GitHub feed was just like filled with just like other people's issues. Quite literally, it was just filled with issues, right. And wasn't good for me. So I've started paring that down. But yeah, I think that's just sort of what you got to do. Find something, a system that works for you, Chris.
Yeah, I mean, I use Pinboard when I'm looking at a page and I want to save it, and I'll just pretty much just click Pinboard and save it. And unfortunately, I very rarely go back to Pinboard. Usually, when I'm trying to find something that I found before, I find myself re-Googling it, which is ridiculous, and there should be a better system. But I mostly use Pinboard to remember things that, just in case I want to search, I know I saved it there, so I'll have better luck finding it if I absolutely can't remember what to Google for. If I'm looking at something cool, which is a part of inspiration, certainly I have a Mac app called Little Snapper, and I just like take a snap of it and put it in there and then paste in the URL and maybe write a little note or tag it or something so I can have my own little personal pattern tap or whatever. Mm-hmm. And it can upload to Flickr, and it can upload to FTP as well. So that's kind of why I started the gallery on CSS Tricks, is because Little Snapper can do that. So I'm like, hey, I'll also have this be part of my website so that other people can check out things that I have found inspiring. So that was a natural transition of using Little Snapper. If I'm reading something inspiring, took me a long time to get into this, but I'm finally using Instapaper, a little Marco Arment app where you just click read it later and it will put things in there. I mostly use it for long form stuff. I'm like, God, I bet that's interesting, but I absolutely don't have time to read it right now. I'll click that. And I used to use it and then I would never go read it. And now I have been finding time to, instead of opening up Google Reader, opening up Instapaper and reading through some of the kind of longer form articles that I knew would be interesting but didn't have time for at the moment. So Pinboard for links, Little Snapper for screenshots, Instapaper for reading, sometimes local bookmarks. And I find this, and then just star it. Like if I'm reading something in Google Reader that I want to remember, I'll just hit star it, or I'll Google plus one it, or I'll like it on Facebook or whatever. I do have this app that kind of aggregates all that crap together, which I'll share if I can remember. I can't remember it right now. But here's the big one. If you have something that you think is amazing and you want to really for sure remember that, I think blogging it yourself is like the most the way to make it totally unforgettable. Be like, I blogged it, so I'm going to go find it on my blog, and I blogged it because I loved it so much that I not only wanted to remember it, but share it.
So, yeah. Well, and you could even do that as a Tumblr, you know? That could be really sure. Awesome. I mean, create a paper trail somehow. So there you go. Hey, thanks for the
question.
Your
own browser's the worst place.
Your own browser's the worst. Oh, totally. Totally. Especially with all these cross-device things now. Oh, God, it's awful. Anyway, so yeah, thanks, Josh. Boom.
Last
one is from Danny LeBlanc. Danny LeBlanc. Is the SCSS syntax and variables something that will possibly come to become a CSS standard at some point? It just seems highly productive, so why not work it into the spec? Bum ba ba. That deserves a ta-da.
Heck yeah. I'm going to tell you, yes, they absolutely will be. I heard a little bird tell me one time that Chrome's basically sitting on the code that makes nesting work, and it's not spec'd, and it might be a little weird to just all of a sudden start supporting that, so they're not yet, but they could just turn it on one day. So, which is pretty interesting, isn't it?
That's like, would you call that a secret?
Yeah, that's why you listen to Shop Talk Show, and we have all the secrets that none of the other podcasts have, which, you know, if you haven't noticed, we've had no sponsors, which is ridiculous because we have all the secrets. So if you have money and you want to have us talk about your stuff in glowing terms, you should maybe contact us through our website.
Great job.
Anyway. I love that.
So I think it totally should be in CSS. It's like once you're on the preprocessor train, you're just like, okay, this is probably how it should be. But I don't know how they're going to make like the @var syntax or whatever it is. And even nesting.
I thought variables would be easy. I would be like, you parse it and you do like a text replace with wherever you use that variable. And then you use that CSS. And I was talking with some spec people and they're like, it's absolutely not that simple. It's actually one of the hardest things that we have to work on. They like variables. Variables is spec'd. And it's just implementing it is apparently very difficult. So variables... I think the syntax is pretty much the same as it is in SAS or SCSS. And it will be part of the spec. It's just a matter of having it work and be performant is kind of the big deal. Not just making it work, but having it work fast like CSS works. Like you don't notice the speed of CSS because it's so ridiculously fast. They can't go back. They can't tread back from that. Anything that's going to be added to CSS forever needs to be so ridiculously fast that you don't even notice. And that was sort of the challenge of CSS3, like making a gradient that can render in a browser so fast that it's just like a solid color. You don't even notice the speed difference, even though it's much harder to do. So what about the other stuff? And the deal with the syntax is it's just going to be with preprocessors is just a small team and they're just like, we're going to do it like this. Okay. Sound good. Hit the gavel. Anyway.
Right. Oh, you were actually asking for a sound effect. Anyway, okay, go ahead.
I was just saying that it was a small team, and they just decide the way it is, and they're like, "Cool, that's how it's going to be now." That's not how the W3C works. You know, it has to be scrutinized. It has to be, you know, gone through all these different states of feedback and stuff. So the syntax might not be exactly the same, but clearly it's a pretty good idea. So it probably most of it will make it into. And these smart people that made these preprocessors, it's not going to be wildly different. If it's different at all, it'll be different for a very good reason and in a way that is better probably. So, yeah. Denny, yes, the stuff that you're getting used to in SCSS will eventually make it to CSS. It will be a long time, a very long time, until we can start using some of that safely. It, you can't just start. It's the day that makes it into the spec is probably literally some. It's, you know, the browsers are moving faster, but it's going to be many, many years before you're able to use nesting in a CSS file and not worry about it. I mean, IE11, you know, IE10, which isn't even out yet, is going to have to be on the way out.
Yeah.
Which is, that's a long time from now.
Well, and that's why another reason you should just use preprocessors, you know, because once that feature's available, like kind of standardized, you can just probably turn it on and say, yes, do that, and it'll start crunching them out. So it's a safe feature. Great question. Thank you very much. Yeah.
Rapid fire, folks. If you got more questions, send them in to shoptalkshow.com/ask. We're always replenishing the coffers of questions. Hopefully these are nice because we can get through a few more questions than we're able to when we have a guest, which is nice. So hopefully we can kind of get to everybody's. I'm going to stop making the promise that we can absolutely do every question that we get because that's getting harder to do. But if you do, your chances are better if you record an MP3, though. Just makes for better radio, don't you agree?
Think about this episode. You heard me stumble through about 10 questions. It's awful, guys. Send in your own. Put your own voice on this thing. Just a little, you know, 30-second, here's my question. And we love them. We absolutely love them. So do it.
All right, folks. Until next time, shoptalkshow.com.